We will hear argument next in case number 24-1783, Ortiz and Associates Consulting versus Vizio. Mr. Ramey.
Good morning. My name is William Ramey and I represent appellant Ortiz and Associates Consulting, LLC. If it pleases the court, may I begin? Ortiz seeks a reversal of the fee shifting under 35 U.S.C. Section 285 because the district court abused its discretion in finding the case exceptional because it was legal error for the district court to use the alleged failure to mark, the alleged failure to have damages to support an award under Section 285. Now that was only one of the many of the four factors the court did, but that was the one that was clearly legal error. And the court first, when it dismissed the case with prejudice, that was the first sanction. It's well established under Fifth Circuit law that a dismissal with prejudice is a sanction. Ortiz decided not to appeal that dismissal and went on down the road, and the 285 motion was then filed because we have a situation where there was a 285 that considered that fact of the alleged failure to mark, alleged failure to have a viable damage claim to support a factor in the totality of the circumstances that justifies an award under Section 285. However, there's nothing unusual about this case. Nothing stands out for the rest. The other three factors chosen by the district court were one that that Ortiz failed to live up to the discovery obligations, failed to serve infringement contentions. That was something that was never raised by Vizio in the case in chief. They never brought that to the district court's attention until in the pleading for the motion for fees. The fact that Vizio hadn't served discovery, or pardon, that Ortiz hadn't served discovery, shouldn't be a factor.
Do I remember right? Tell me if I'm wrong. That the district court's fee opinion never says, even if the failure to plead compliance with 287 is not kind of does not make the case brought exceptionally meritless, the other factors would support my fee award even by themselves. Is that right?
The district court did say that. The district court did say that it's totality of the four circumstances.
Right. I'm not asking my question clearly enough. I took it from the district court's opinion that the judge never said, even if there was no exceptionally bad failure to plead marking, that the other factors would alone support characterizing the case as exceptional.
I didn't take that from the district court's opinion, Your Honor. What I took from that was he was balancing all four of them, and the first one where I found there was clearly glare, getting into the other three factors, the not following the discovery requirements of the court, we never had brought to our attention that infringement contentions weren't served. There was a procedure under the miscellaneous Rule 62 in the Northern District of Texas where we could have applied to serve infringement contentions. And in fact, the record evidence before the court is that Ortiz planned to do that after it got past the motion to dismiss stage. The other factor within that discovery obligations of the court were not serving discovery. It's not uncommon in many courts, as in the Western District of Texas, that we don't even start discovery until after the markment. There's still plenty of time on the court's ordered docket control order for Ortiz to serve discovery, get responses, and build its case. They plan to do that later on, conserving fees for both the plaintiff and the defendant until after the motion to dismiss stage. The third factor, it's the third factor that the court used in assessing fees was that made a settlement demand that was well below the merits of the case. And Ortiz's settlement demand very early on in the case was $149,000. The fee motion that Vizio submitted only requested fees of
$166,000.
My bad on reading that. That includes the briefing on the motion for fees. So before that, the $149,000 was right along with what the parties have spent to date. And it's not uncommon for clients that can't afford to go into seven-digit figures spending on litigation to try to balance the cost of litigation with their settlement demands. And so early on in the case,
Counsel, just so we level set, you agree that the patents were expired, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so in light of that, then you'd be looking for, obviously, past damages of anything, not future, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And because of kind of the circumstances of this case, do you disagree that you would need to plead something sufficient to show that you would have some plausible entitlement to past damages?
We addressed that in our response to the motion to dismiss the First Amendment complaint. When we brought to the court's attention that we did, that we had in fact pled, we were saying that we were non-practicing entity with no products to mark, and that in all of our licensees, that we have the settlement license, or there were a few of them prior to my time, that they weren't producing a patented Article 4 under Ortiz's patents. And that's how we pled it in a response to the motion to dismiss. And that's, had we been provided a chance to amend our complaint, we would have added that back into the complaint. That's what we were asking for, was a chance to amend the complaint. But the decision was made at that time not to appeal the dismissal. And so that's what finds us to kind of a unique procedural history, as it were.
So let me just see if I understand. I think you just said that in opposing the motion to dismiss, you said there is no license, we have no licensee practicing this patent. But you did not put that into your either original complaint or the amended complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor. We were anticipating having the court direct, you know, providing some guidance as to whether or not we were required to plead that when we put it into our motion to dismiss response.
So your position is, which was not in the First Amended complaint, but nonetheless your position now is that, I take it, that there was no marking requirement because neither, in this case, Roku or Panasonic was practicing either of the two patents. Is that right?
It was my understanding from talking to the client at the time when we were drafting the brief is that I wasn't involved in those cases, Your Honor.
Right, but I understand. But you, what I take it you're saying now is that Roku and Panasonic did not practice the patents, and therefore there's no marking requirement.
They did not believe they practiced the patents.
Right, but then why did you sue them in the first place?
Ortiz firmly believes they infringed the patents.
Well, but I think you just said that Ortiz advised you that they didn't practice the patents.
That the defendants, Panasonic and Roku, believed that they were not infringing the patents.
Right, the defendants believed that, but what did Ortiz believe?
Ortiz believed that they were infringing the patents, and that's why they filed the Patent Infringement Act. That is a... we take that to be a different type of license. That's a license to end litigation, which we refer to in our briefing as a settlement license. And this court has viewed settlement licenses, notice the distinction between settlement licenses and licenses to produce a patented article. And in the strict language of Section 287A, it's the intent of the parties has to be to produce a patented article for or under the patents at issue. And here the defendants, my understanding is from the Roku and Panasonic contended they did not infringe and that they were not producing a patented article for under the Ortiz patents from the...
In the settlement agreements, did you have a provision relating to marking?
In those prior settlement agreements, I don't believe that those settlement agreements were considered in the case below until the fee motion, and that those were just motions to dismiss. And so I don't believe that's part of the record, Your Honor, in this case.
Well, if it was just a motion to dismiss, and it was dismissed, and a naked motion to dismiss, it didn't say anything about marking, right?
Pardon me.
Have you seen those motions?
Maybe I misunderstood the question. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I was just following up on Judge Cunningham's question. Yes. Have you seen the motions to dismiss in those two prior cases?
Your Honor, I did not review in preparation for the hearing today. The motions in those prior cases, I did not review them.
Okay.
So my apologies for that. But we would simply simply say that the licenses that were that Ortiz was granted were licenses to end litigation. The defendants, the high cost of litigation, the uncertainty of litigation. And so it's a different type of a license. And by the strict language of 287A, it requires, you know, a person, that a patentee who's practicing the invention to mark, or a patentee who has licensed his inventions for another to practice those, to practice those claims to produce a patented article. And here, neither of those, Roku or Panasonic defendants. And that leads us back to the fact that it would be, it was legal error for the district court to use that as a factor in determining whether or not this case was exceptional. But I promise you to get to all four of the factors. And the one factor, the fourth factor that the judge talked about, well, let me talk about the settlement demands a little bit. The court said that a $149,000 settlement was a nuisance value settlement, and I would say that that isn't a nuisance value settlement for the stage of the case. That the median income in America, I put it into the briefing, is far less than that at the time. So that can't be considered a nuisance value. And the cost that Vizio sought indicates that that was not a nuisance value. So that's a clear error in fact that the district used in assessing fees under Section 285. And the last one, that Ortiz dismissed many lawsuits about the motion to dismiss.
Would you agree, though, that the proposition that I think the district court was basing its ruling on this issue on, a nuisance value, i.e. a settlement offer for less than the prospective cost of the defense, is a factor that can be considered in determining whether this is an exceptional case. Would you agree with that proposition?
I would not. I've toiled with this one for a lot in a lot of different cases, reading different opinions of this court. And while I see that low settlement offers to extract a settlement from a defendant have been determined by this court to be a factor supporting an exceptional case findings,
right,
what that value is and whether or not...
No, but just as an abstract matter. In other words, if a defendant is looking at, well, if I go all the way through a motion to dismiss or have to go through summary judgment with the attendant discovery, this is going to cost me somewhere between $200,000 and $1 million, let's say. If that's the defendant's calculation and you offer a settlement for $100,000 or $150,000, do you regard that as a factor that the court can take into account in determining whether there is an exceptional case in the instance?
No, Your Honor. The only evidence in this case, the record evidence, is that it's a practice of many of the plaintiffs that I represent, that we start with a lower settlement offer, but we raise our settlement offer as we go on through the case. So that we approach...
Right, but that practice, as this court has said, can be abusive. Because what you can be, either fairly or unfairly, depending on your perspective, accused of is having taken advantage of the fact that legal fees are very high these days, and you can offer something that is plenty enough to satisfy your client, but forces the other side to choose between defense and getting out of the case for less. In many instances, they'll get out of the case for less. That, this court has said, at least nakedly expressed, is abusive.
If the way that it's handled is abusive, then I can see this court finding that as abusive. However, the way that this was handled, this particular case, looking solely at this case, it was not abusive, and we're not applying generalities to settlement offers, but this court places a high value on resolving cases. And to take away the ability to resolve cases early on, there's not all defendants that can afford, all plaintiffs that can afford a seven-figure defense, or a seven-figure, you know, going out there and suing people. So that's why the settlements are often structured such that they can resolve cases before we get to that seven figures being spent by the plaintiff.
That's what contingent fees are for.
Yes, Your Honor, and if in some cases, yes, Your Honor. So if I'm going to do a little bit more, if I could, real quick, and then I'll reserve the rest of my time. But I don't think, if you look at the facts of this case, there's nothing to indicate that it was abusive. So just as being a general factor, it wasn't abusive in this case. So it shouldn't be used as something to support an award of fees. And briefly, on the fourth one, that we filed many lawsuits and dismissed before the motion to dismiss stage, the district court didn't take any evidence of what those dismissals were. And this court has said in the Rescue case, that, 594 Fed Third 860, that we need more to base that as a factor. And I'll reserve the rest of my time if I may, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Stephen Hartz on behalf of Vizio. The only issue before this Court today is whether the District Court abused its discretion in finding this case exceptional and awarding fees. The District Court did not abuse its discretion. All the factors that the District Court considered and its factual findings are supported by this Court's precedents and the record. I'd like to first start with the marking issue. The issue here is Ortiz. This Court is very clear in Arctic Cat that it is the patentee's burden to plead compliance with the marking statute. And District Courts, again, as Your Honor pointed out, the only damages available in this case were past damages. There are a lot of District Courts that say, particularly when you're trying to seek past damages, you must plead compliance with the marking statute.
What in the circumstances of Ortiz's situation would have sufficed as a pleading?
I think that answer has two components. First, Ortiz would need to address itself. So I think Ortiz...
You said, we don't make any goods, so we got nothing
Ortiz
to mark.
Ortiz would probably say, yes, we don't make any products, and therefore we have nothing to mark. But the marking statute also applies to licensees. And Ortiz has admitted it does have licensees.
Marking statute does not use the word licensee, does it?
No, but the court's precedents have said that
marking doesn't... Well, maybe not all licensees are of a piece. 287 says it's four or under the patent. And
yes.
Here, I think the District Court didn't go further than saying there were two companies, Panasonic and Roku, that had settled suits with dismissal with prejudice. What more should Ortiz have pled? Would it have been enough if it had pled what it said in its opposition to dismiss?
I think with the licensee issue, there's three issues. I think it would need to say, one, we have no licensees, and therefore there's no other entity that ostensibly has to mark. Two, they would have to say that their licensees did mark, substantially mark, plead some facts or something like that. Or three, they would have to say that whatever products were being made or are subject to the license are not patented articles and don't fall under the statute. So I think in order for, in this case, for Ortiz to have made a pleading, it would need to have said, again, we Ortiz, we're non-practice entity, we don't have products to mark. Furthermore, we either don't have licensees, which I don't think Ortiz could make that statement under Rule 11, because it has licensees.
Well, suppose it had said, we don't have licensees in a sense that would be sufficient to say that their products are made for or under, I think the language is the patentee, not even under the patent. But
under the patentee, that's right.
It's been
construed that way.
Yeah, it's a little bit odd, but for or under the patentee, the two... we have certain settlements. Two of them are ones in which we believed that, based on the information we had at the time we sued, that the defendants had products that infringed, but the two defendants insisted otherwise. It seems to me like that would be enough. And if that were enough, how in the world were you harmed by their failure to say that?
Potentially it would have been enough. I think it would depend on the wordings of whether the District Court would find that they've pleaded sufficient facts to allow it to make a claim for damages such that the District Court could actually grant relief by the lawsuit. Here, though, we apprised Ortiz of the requirement to plead marking. This is Arctic Cat in our first motion to dismiss, as well as all the case law. Ortiz filed an amended complaint, but Ortiz ignored all of the case law and evidence that we presented in our first motion to dismiss. And again, it filed a complaint that didn't address marking or damages or any of the case law at all. It essentially just doubled down and said, we don't have to do it. And the District Court, in dismissing this case, found It found that Roku and Panasonic had licenses by operation of law. But as an independent basis, the district court said that Ortiz was on notice of the requirement to plead compliance with the marketing statute, and it failed to do it. It didn't say anything. And as for the harm, in filing this lawsuit, Vizio must...
Again, to follow up on Judge Toronto's question, what difference did that make in terms of the injury to you?
The injury is, again, because only passive images were available, Ortiz must make a requisite pleading in order to unlock those passive images. By not doing so, this case is frivolous in that there's nothing the district court can...
If the district court is right in thinking that the marking requirement applied in this case, then all those past damages go away. But that happens whether they plead it or not. In other words, if you ended up if this case went on, you would be able to say, number one, we think the marking requirement applies, and number two, they weren't marked, therefore, you get no past damages.
Yes.
Right. And why was the fact that wasn't in the pleading injurious to you?
It's injurious to us because they filed the complaint, and that requires Vizio to read the patents, look up defenses, start looking at the products at issue, participate in scheduling conferences. Vizio has to expend a lot of time, money, and resources in starting to defend itself against a case in which no viable damage theory was ever pled. Thus, the district court would never be able to offer any relief. That's how Vizio is injured. I think probably the point you're getting at is, in this case in particular, I think had they made the requisite pleading, I think we probably ultimately, at the end of the day, based on what's kind of come out in some of the briefing, have wound up at this point maybe in a summary judgment context, and it would have just been, again, even more time and money and effort.
Now, the assumption that the district court made, I think it's an assumption, was that if the back damages were unavailable, given the fact that the patent had expired, then there would be no damages at all. But as I understand the record, and correct me if I'm not right about this, but there's a 6-year statute of limitations. The case was filed in 23, so that takes us back to 17. But the two settlements, I think, were in 19. So even if those two settlements constitute licenses for which the marking requirement applied, then there still would be damages, would there not, between 17 and 19?
Potentially. But again, I also think, this comes to the district court's...
But didn't the district court kind of assume away all of the back damages?
Well, its dismissal order was based on two things. One is what I call the operation by law of Panasonic and Roku. And the district court agreed with our legal analysis and logic, and Ortiz did not dispute any of that in their opposition. But the district court also said, just as an independent basis, Ortiz never pled anything. And that in and of itself was an independent basis to wipe out all past damages, because it never made any pleading that it would allow it to receive any type of past damages, even if only a fraction. If I could turn briefly to the other issues, the district court also found, I think rightly, that in this case it's undisputed that Ortiz did not serve infringement contentions, initial disclosures, or anything like that. The district court's scheduling order was very clear. I think it's appendix page 563, that the pendency of a Rule 12 motion does not stay the litigation absent an order from the court. Ortiz never took it upon it, never went to the district court and said, can we pause this until the court rules on the motion to dismiss? Ortiz admits in its briefing to the district court that it unilaterally took it upon itself to say, we're not going to serve any of this stuff, and we'll take care of it later when and if we survive the motion to dismiss. I heard counsel talk about the rules, the Texas patent rules that allow you to amend, that allows you to make amendments for good cause. That's usually for, you know, we've added products, we've used source code, and we want to refine our theories. I do not think the good cause is I unilaterally decided not to follow the court's rules, and now I want to do over.
Can I ask? So we have some cases, and just, you know, correct me about these premises. I guess I think of the Rembrandt case that talks about how fees that are awarded have to be have some nexus, causal connection to the conduct that made the case exceptional. How would that be true of the failure to file infringement contentions? I understand how it would be true if the case from the get-go exceptionally underpled, because then the whole case would be the result. But how does this failure to file infringement contentions cause any excess fees?
I think this goes to I'm not sure it goes to excess fees, but I think it goes to the Supreme Court's octane fitness, where it's also, you consider the manner in which the case was litigated. And so I think I think octane fitness talks about substantial weakness of your litigating position as well as the manner in which you litigated the case. And here,
I guess part of what I'm trying to figure out is, for purposes of this question only, if I had some doubts about the failure to plead ground, whether it really could be the case that either the fee that was awarded or any fees could rest on the other bases that the district court considered.
I think this answers your question. I don't read the district court's opinion as saying that the four factors that it considered, that each one in and of itself is an independent basis that allows fees. I understand the district court's opinion to say the district court has considered these four factors, and when you consider the four factors in totality, the district court said that this case was exceptional.
Can I change the subject to this nuisance offer business and this concept of abusiveness? What exactly is abusive or wrong about, and now I'm going to make up some facts, a moneyless patent owner bringing lawsuits against a variety of defendants that, and I'm going to assume here now, is substantively non-frivolous, and hoping that a few of the defendants will pay up to get out of the suit, again, non-frivolous claims, providing the plaintiff some money to go up against the wealthy defendants who have vast resources to outspend the plaintiff that the plaintiff could not possibly match without getting funding. What's abusive about that?
In the abstract, I think I haven't really given this much thought, but I would think if the claims are not frivolous, then the patent owner would be able to really articulate a case on the merits. I think the problem with this case is the settlement demand that was made was, as Ortiz pointed out in its briefing to the district court, was based on Ramey LLP, the litigation law firm's practice. It's not even Ortiz's practice. It wasn't based on the value of the technology. It's not based on any of the merits of the case. Here, it seems to be, and this is what the district court found,
we have this kind of unavoidable fact that patent litigation is fantastically expensive. The cost of it can never be outside the real world view of both parties in how to proceed. So I guess what I struggle with here and have been struggling with even outside this case, is how to think about this phenomenon of bringing multiple suits as bearing on an inquiry without the premise of, I'm going to just call it frivolousness of the suit. And I'm using a broad concept of frivolous to include here, for purposes of this question, failure to plead something.
Yeah. If I understand your question, I think one of the hallmarks that this court should kind of consider is really whether the patent owner is willing to test the merits of its case. And here, the district court looked at the prior litigation history and noticed that, I think before Ortiz sued Vizio, there had been 11 suits that had been filed, and
they're too poor to test it unless they get some settlements to provide funding to test it against the big players.
I think they need to test the merits of their case. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I also see that I'm over my time.
Besides the issue on marking, is there anything else the court pointed to regarding the substantive weakness of the litigation position?
No, the court, we raised other what I would call technical issues about within the claims and whether systems and servers and all that kind of stuff. But we raised all that in our briefing, but the district court did not address that in its opinion. It confined itself to the marking issue.
If I could ask one more question along the lines of Judge Cunningham's question. What, in your view, would have been minimally sufficient to put in the complaint to satisfy the marking requirement under circumstances in this case in which, number one, the patentee is not making and selling the goods themselves. And number two, let's assume that the patentee will treat the settlements as licenses, but has information that the licensees do not regard their sales of their products as being covered by the patents. What, and under those circumstances, what exactly is the minimally sufficient pleading that should have shown up in the First Amendment complaint?
I think, again, it would need to say, we Ortiz are non-practicing, we don't have products to mark. And then as far as the licensees, again, I think the case law is, it really doesn't matter what the licensee thinks. It's whether the claim language reads on the patent. So if the licensee has a license to the 299.
Right, but if the licensee doesn't think that the products are covered by the patents, they're not going to mark.
But that can be, whether you have an obligation to mark or not, that's something that can be put in the settlement agreement. And if you're in
well, I know, but take these facts. So you've got exactly this case, plus we'll assume Ortiz knows that the Roku and Panasonic do not believe that their products are covered by the patents. Under those circumstances, what should have been in the complaint about the Roku and Panasonic products?
Then I think Ortiz would have needed to have, going back to what I said earlier, pleaded that the products are not covered for whatever facts and reasons they can plead, or
well, Ortiz can hardly say that they weren't covered since Ortiz sued them.
And I kind of think that's.
But he can say that they don't believe they were covered, yeah. And that's why they're not marking.
And Ortiz also would also need to plead facts showing that they undertook reasonable steps and efforts to get its licensees to mark the patents. And again, I think that would be something that the district court then would have to decide whether that was sufficient or not.
Right.
If there are any other questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Can you give 3 minutes? Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may address a couple things very quickly. The district court's order, in my opinion, places a new burden on a patent plaintiff to plead compliance with Section 287A when some other lawsuit has been dismissed with prejudice. That could be taken from this holding. I think that 287A is a very specific statute, as the court was addressing with my colleague on the other side. It requires a patentee who produces a patent article to mark, or a patentee who licenses another produce a patent article under the patentee. And that is correct language. And here, regardless of whether Ortiz settled lawsuits with other defendants, if those settlements weren't of such, which aren't in this record, but if they weren't of such character that they were to produce a patented article under the patentee's patents, that wouldn't trigger 287A by the express language of 287A. And I go back to this court's Arctic Cat holding that Section 287 is a limitation on damages, not an affirmative defense. And that even comes back from 1984 from the Motorola versus United States case at 729 Fed Second 765. And maybe more importantly for this court's resolution of this appeal is that compliance with Section 287 is a question of fact. And we're at the pleading stage. At the pleading stage, all reasonable inferences are taken for the patentee. We requested leave to amend if the district court found that we needed to put something else in, and that wasn't granted. We didn't appeal that, but that's why we reviewed the legal error for the district court to consider that as a factor.
You mentioned Arctic Cat, and it does specifically state that the patentee bears the burden of pleading and proving he complied with the 287A marking requirement.
Yes, Your Honor. And so I like to look at the facts. Arctic Cat was very specific, right? We had a patentee who licensed a third party, licensed Honda to produce a patented article. Honda said, oh, we're not going to mark our products in the settlement agreement. And then they went on and Honda wasn't marking their products. The patentee went off and sued someone else. That other person brought up the fact that, hey, Honda hasn't been marking their patents. And this court said here, even though by that time Arctic Cat had quit producing their own products, so they were an MPE, by that time they were previously producing a patented article. And then so this court then said, well, in this particular case, here's a license agreement that says, hey, Honda, you're here, I believe it's Honda, my apologies if I'm wrong, but to go on and produce this patent article, and you have to, you know, and then Honda said, well, we're not going to put a patent number on that. Specifically, the court found that MP, that under those circumstances, under those facts, an MP does have to mark it. We're not disagreeing with that. If we had licensed Roku to say, hey, you're to produce this patented article, and Roku said, yeah, but we're not going to mark, that would be a very different set of facts than what we have here. Here we have Roku say, we just want out of this litigation. And Panasonic, we just went out of this litigation. That's very different than, if I'm continuing, I'm out of time now, but I'll tie it up. Did I address your question, Your Honor?
If you had more to the answer, I want to hear the answer.
I think that's Arctic Cat, I think, is a very specific set of facts that 100% means that MPEs that license someone to produce a patent article, and that person does produce that patented article, have an obligation to mark. And I think that we go back to what the intention of the parties is when they enter into that settlement agreement, settlement license, or licensing agreement. That's where, and that's just not in the record here, but that's what's going to tell whether there was an obligation to mark.
So this is my last question to you. Are you contending that there should be a different rule for NPEs with respect to what ARCAT requires?
No, Your Honor.
Versus other companies.
I'm sorry, I don't think there should be a different rule. I think that NPEs should be held to the exact same standards. And it's whether you're licensing for or under the patentee's patents, and if to produce a patented article. If the other side isn't saying they're doing that, you're never going to have cases settled. If then that's just going to be an impediment to settle. Here I'm saying that it just goes back to contract interpretation. Just go back, what did the parties intend when they entered into this? I mean, a plaintiff can intend all day long that the defendant needs to mark. And if the defense says, no, we're never going to mark, cases will never resolve. And so if the parties are clear in their intentions in the agreement, that settles this issue for the court, because the courts, just because this is a patent infringement case where someone sues someone for patent infringement, doesn't change the age-old doctrine that we go back to state law and look at what was the intent of the parties that's expressed in the writing, that every clause in there has meaning. This can be given effect. You can't read out certain means. If the defense says, hey, we don't infringe, we're not marking. We don't infringe, and Patty says, well, there's a disagreement on infringement, disagreement on validity, but we just want to end this litigation. That makes it a very different license, settlement license, or whatever you want to call it, than a license to produce a patented article for or under the patentee's patents. And that's all I mean by that, Your Honor. And with that, I thank the court. If there's any questions, I can answer. I thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. Case is submitted.